This is Barbara Leslie, President of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, two of the three major wildfires burning in Northern California are now the second and third largest in state history, according to CAL FIRE, the LNU complex fire in and around wine country, and the SCU complex fire burning to the east and south of San Francisco. The Bay Area was largely spared the brunt of last night's thunderstorm activity, which hit mostly in the Central Valley and Sierra Nevada. We get the latest on the wildfires, the strain it's having on firefighters, and new efforts to thin and manage forests. Join us after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Northern California was largely spared from last night's weather system that threatened dry lightning and strong winds. Still, the Bay Area's three major lightning-sparked fire complexes have now raged for a week or more. Together, they've burned more than 1 million acres, destroyed about 1,000 structures, and hundreds of thousands of people are under evacuation orders. We want to hear from you. How are you faring after several days of blazes? And joining us first is Scott McLean, spokesman for CAL FIRE. Thanks for joining us, Scott McLean.
Thank you for having me.
And I should ask you the question, how are firefighters faring after this week of multiple blazes?
Well, since you brought up the weather last night, the predicted weather forecast was definitely daunting. However, what we received was much, much better news for us. So we continue to get line strengthens, getting those lines further around these fires. The firefighters definitely are tired, but they're still working hard at it. Both the men and women have just given it their all.
Yes, give us a sense of the progress made by firefighters over the weekend and what conditions are like today for you.
The conditions, you know, the predicted winds, they're probably going to surface a little later. It's looking real calm here at base camp, for an example, and up on the ridgetops I can see it seems to be relatively calm, but there is some breezes, which definitely, as we all know, promote fires, especially in this area. They continue to work around the clock on these fires, especially the Hennessy as well as the Wahlberg. We're looking at a total acreage right now as of this morning of 350,000 acres. Mm. At 22% containment. The containment continues to climb. Now, keep in mind, the Myers fire that's over north of Jenner off the coast is 95% contained at 2,360 acres. So that one's pretty much put to bed. The Wahlberg is definitely a fight still to be had. It is still very active. It is 5% contained. But again, the firefighters did an awful lot of work last night and were able to make a lot of headway, even though that 5% figure doesn't sound like it. They have, especially with the type of topography. And then the Hennessy, all those fires that merged and, you know, basically wrapped Lake Berryessa. So we still have some activity up in the northwestern corner towards Lower Lake. We had the Rocky Fire, we had the Jerusalem Fire, we had the Clayton Fire up in that area in the years past. So that area always seems to be pretty active. There's really been no increase in acreage past our lines. What has burned over the course of last night was expected, and that's at 26% contained. Again, burning 293,000 acres, still a lot of work to do, but a lot of black line on it.
Well, glad to hear that. Are you anticipating then that you will not need to issue more evacuation orders, or that even you can downgrade some or even lift any?
We evaluate on a consistent basis throughout the course of each day. So I'm not and do not want the public to be complacent, because anything can happen at any time. And by that I mean we could get an ember across the line and it could start another spot fire and promote the main body of the fire to go in that direction. We all have to work together. We have to keep our heads on a swivel. You know, help us help you, the public, by, you know, staying out of those evacuated areas, and especially in those warning areas, please be prepared. ReadyForWildfire.org. I ask that you go to that website and review it. A lot of very helpful information on what to do in case of a wildfire. And to answer your question direct, we are not out of the woods yet. Anything could happen. We are repopping as well as issuing evacuation warnings or orders at the same time. So it's really in a state of flux.
Can you give us a quick update on containment of the SCU fire, the one that's in the East Bay, South Bay, and more? I mean, so many counties are affected by that one, and also the CZU.
Mm-hmm. Stats this morning on the SCU, Santa Clara Unit Lightning Complex, we're looking at 347,000-plus acres burned, primarily in grass and brush. It's at 10% containment. And then as I'm going, the CZU Lightning Complex, Santa Cruz, Monterey, we're looking at 78,000 acres of brush and timber, and that's at 13% containment. We're looking at 1.2 million-plus acres burned in this period of time. To put it in perspective, we saw 1.9 million acres burn in 2018, the whole year. 2017 was 1.6 million acres burned. And we just burned 1.2 million acres in just over a week.
I mean, that's incredible. And I mean, how long should people expect it to be before the fires are more or less handled? I mean, as you mentioned, we're nowhere near out of the woods yet.
It's really hard to say. I mean, we are in drought-like conditions. We remain in drought-like conditions. One winter is not going to make or break it. We need a consistent, weather pattern for a few years in order to get California back on that plateau of moisture content in our vegetation, to put it simply. So there's really no set time. We're going to see this throughout the rest of the year as far as the volatility of our fuels, our vegetation. So we need to have that mindset of being very careful and very cognizant of our surroundings, all of us in this state.
And Scott McLean, before I let you go, could you tell us whether or not reinforcements are coming in a timely manner?
Again, 1.2 million acres all over the state of California. So resources are out there. They're doing their jobs. I'm feeling comfortable now, but in the same sense, you know, there's always a chance of these weather patterns that come in, so we need to be paying attention to that. Give you an idea of out-of-state resources. We've received 91 fire engines from out-of-state. They came from the states of Arizona, Idaho, New Mexico, Texas, Oregon, Utah, and Washington. Our resources from the National Guard are a big help on the ground and in the air. Our Conservation Corps folks are a big help. We were able to hire almost 850 Firefighter Ones, or what we call seasonal firefighters, to put them into a crew format, several crew format. That is helping. So all this is helping, but again, we need to have the public's help as well, being that extra careful, being very, very cautious out there until and throughout the end of the year. So again, we have to be together on this.
Scott McLean, CAL FIRE spokesman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Joining us for the rest of the hour is KQED's Dan Brecke, editor and reporter for KQED News. Hi, Dan Brecke.
Hi, Mina Kim.
And also with us is Keith Gillis, professor and dean emeritus at the College of Natural Resources at UC Berkeley and chair of the California Board of Forestry and Fire Protection. Keith Gillis, thanks so much for joining us as well.
My pleasure to be here.
And Keith Gillis, I have to ask you, we did hear a little bit from Scott McLean about how the conditions are different from, you know, the fires that we've had, the catastrophic fires, just in the last 5 years or so. What else do you think we need to understand about how things are different this time from, say, the Wine Country and Thomas fires?
The wine country fires are perhaps a better analogy than the Tompkins fire, but what makes this situation so difficult for Cal Fire are the number of simultaneous fire starts. That a dry lightning storm, which is something that thankfully we only see on this magnitude on about a 15-20 year cycle historically, it creates so many ignitions simultaneously that just the logistics of finding the resources and dispatching them under ordinary timelines to do your initial attack on these fires becomes difficult to impossible. You just can't get your normal complement of resources to each ignition with the speed you normally do. So that creates a situation where fires can burn longer without response and where there's a potential for them coalescing. Fires that you might have been able to handle easily, were you dealing with only one or two ignitions in a county, you've suddenly got 10 to 15 ignitions. It changes the nature of the response. When you've got an area-wide dry lightning storm like this, it means that it's harder for Cal Fire or other fire agencies to move resources between Cal Fire units or counties, because the next county over is also engaged with a large number of starts. I think it's remarkable how well mutual aid does work in these situations, but it's hard to get a lot of out-of-state resources here for what would normally be an initial attack situation on small fires. But that system, as Chief McLean points out, works very well when you're in an extended large fire attack like we're in right now.
And we saw that incredible stat that we got some 1,200 lightning strikes that first weekend. And Dan Bricky, could you also clarify the situation in terms of inmate firefighters? It sounds like there's been some reporting out there that has suggested that the lack of inmate firefighters was due to COVID-19 infections, but it's not quite that simple.
No, there are a couple things going on. I mean, one thing is definitely the appearance of COVID in some of the fire camps, the places where the inmate firefighters train. And that has led to some quarantines among the firefighting force there. I think the state expected about 2,100 inmate firefighters to be available this year. And what the force actually available now is about 1,300. That 800 doesn't sound like a lot when you're talking about, 10 or 12 or 14,000 firefighters statewide. But these crews do the toughest jobs on the fire line. They actually go in and cut fire line by hand. And it's the most dangerous, dirty, brutal job you can find in firefighting. That 800 has to be backfilled with other firefighters, as Scott McLean suggested. But the other thing is that there's been a long-term drawdown of the inmate firefighting force. A few years ago, there were about 3,500 firefighters available from inmate sources, and that has gone down to about 2,100, and we'll pick that up later.
And many of the firefighters were released to protect them from the virus as opposed to them actually being sick with it is one of the points of clarification, as I understand it. We'll have more with Dan Bricky, editor and reporter for KQED News, and Keith Gillis, chair of the California Board of Forestry and Fire Protection, after the break. And we'll have more with you, our listeners. Join the conversation by calling 866-733-6786 or on Twitter and Facebook at KQED Forum. You can also email your questions to forum@kqed.org. Tell us how the fires are affecting you directly or indirectly, and what questions you have about firefighting resources, and also just how to deal with the frequency of these massive fires. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're getting the latest on wildfires raging in Northern California and looking at how the region and you are faring after several days of blazes. First, we had an update from one of our reporters in the field. Kevin Stark is at the LNU Fire Base Camp in Calistoga. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Mina.
So what did you hear today, especially since it looks like those thunderstorms didn't materialize as badly as feared?
Yeah, I think fire officials here are kind of breathing a bit of a sigh of relief, you know, taking the good news where they can get it. The thunderstorms that everybody feared were going to sweep through the Bay Area and start new fires. There was a few lightning strikes, but it does not appear that there was any fires that were started last night. So, you know, that's a really good sign. The firefighters around base camp just seem a bit more relaxed today. Last week was just so chaotic as this fire and other fires just continued to grow so rapidly. You know, the last I checked, we're still in a red flag warning here, but fire officials are saying they think the worst of this kind of weather pattern has passed us.
Glad to hear that they're breathing a bit of a sigh of relief. In terms of reinforcements, I mean, what's the status of that?
Yeah, so this fire is still pretty understaffed. There are fewer than 2,000 firefighters right now that are battling this blaze. But as I was driving in this morning, I think I counted 12 or 13 engine. So, you know, they're coming in. California has requested assistance from out of state. I'm told that right now there are 78 fire engines that are from out of state that are here, that are fighting fires. You know, this is from places like Arizona and Idaho, Texas, other places. And they're expecting that reinforcement to trickle in throughout the week. I'm told that there are 8 fire engines that are en route from Montana right now.
And Kevin, it sounded like from speaking with Scott McLean at the top that there has been some progress made on certain sections of this fire. It is so massive, but I guess any little bit of progress is really good news. What are you hearing along those lines?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, this is the second largest fire in state history. It's 350,000 burned acres right now. Fortunately, only 3,000 of those acres were last night. The fire just did not grow very much. And firefighters were able to gain a percent containment. We're at 22%, and they're telling me that they'll take every percent that they can get. Obviously, I think they're going to be working really hard today to increase that and to try and get their hands around these fires.
Well, Kevin Stark, thanks for being there, and stay safe. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, that's Kevin Stark for KQED, a reporter for us. And Dan Brecke, I mean, the LNU fire proportionally has been the most destructive in this, in terms of structures and even deaths. Can you give us the latest on the death toll? Because I understand it has increased over the weekend.
Well, they're saying that the total number of deaths on the LNU fire is, just to remind people, this is a series of incidents that stretches from the Sonoma County coast north of Jenner all the way to Vacaville. And then north into Lake County, where the biggest fires are. But they're saying that a total of 5 people have died in the LNU blaze, and one in the CZU lightning complex, which is the one burning in Santa Cruz and San Mateo County. And then there was another firefighting related death last week in the Central Valley when a helicopter pilot was killed while fighting a fire there near Coalinga. So that's the total toll we know of right now. Probably there's some caution involved in stating a firm number at this point, because the areas burned are so vast that, it's possible that further fatalities will be discovered.
And what have you heard, Dan, about how people who've had to evacuate their homes, had to flee their homes, are faring, especially in light of the pandemic?
Well, this is not the, the normal situation. I mean, And I use the word normal with some hesitancy, obviously. So when people usually have to flee a fire, when they're told on very short notice that you have to leave home and go someplace, usually there are Red Cross evacuation centers set up. And those can take care of basic needs and give people just a place to stay. Of course, they're usually in indoor settings, what we're calling congregate settings now during the pandemic, where it would be very hard to social distance. And so people are very hesitant to use those centers even when they're set up. And instead, people are resorting to things like pitching tents in the open if they can, if there's space available. That's happened, for instance, in Santa Cruz County, and or finding hotel rooms. People are finding hotel rooms on their own, or the Red Cross and other agencies are finding hotel rooms for people who are in need. And, you know, I have to say, I do listen to commercial radio for news every once in a while. and there are hotel chains that are actually inviting people with special deals if they've been forced out of their homes. But I think the real, you know, the real problem for people is, especially if you look to the South, you know, there are people who have moved from one place to another as the fires have moved, and they can't find a place to settle. There were people, for instance, camped outside, as I mentioned, in tents. And then the authorities were telling people yesterday, you know, we need you to take down your tents and go someplace else, because with thunderstorms coming through, it's not safe. And on that last note, I just wanted to say that the National Weather Service did cancel the red flag warning for the Bay Area related to the fires, which is good news.
Again, we're talking with Dan Brecke, editor and reporter for KQED News, and also with you, our listeners. If some of these experiences sound like things that you are going through or that you've heard family and friends going through, tell us at 866-733-6786. Keith Gillis is also with us, professor and dean emeritus at the College of Natural Resources at UC Berkeley and chair of the California Board of Forestry and Fire Protection. And Keith Gillis, Dan Brecke used the word normal, and I just want to ask you, just, is this, in terms of the intensity of the wildfires that we're seeing, a new normal for us? I mean, given the fact that some of these largest, most destructive fires have happened in the last, I mean, in state history have happened in the last decade. What are we looking at here?
To some extent, it is a new normal. The list of the top 10 or top 20 largest fires is largely a history of the last 40 years in California. There are very few fires on that top 10 most destructive or the top 10 largest fires that did not occur since just my joining the Berkeley faculty in the 80s. So it is a modern phenomenon. Climate change is real. It's not a Chinese hoax. And you can expect extreme events to occur with greater probability, whether that's extreme heat events, extreme wind events, extreme drought. And so the sort of factors which have been behind how bad some of these fires got, they are consistent with every really credible prediction of what the California climate has and will become. So it's time to look out the window and look at what's going on out there and say, all right, we really need to get serious about adaptation and mitigation with respect to climate. Both the state's been a leader in this, but it's time for the nation and the world to really address the fact that these extreme events will increase in probability, and we have to adapt to what we're seeing out the window right now.
Yes, and one of the things that often comes up, especially after these wildfires, is this question of increased development in woodland areas. I mean, has it made the situation more difficult for firefighters to manage?
It can, and I would say it has. So you could say, perhaps we should have green-lined all our cities and dramatically increase the density in urban areas. On the other hand, I don't think that this is primarily an issue, the losses of people, the population increasing in rural areas. We have learned a great deal in the last couple of decades about how to build safely in areas that have a wildfire risk. That's as simple as what kind of materials you require for siding, what kind of windows you require, the need to have the vents into your attic space, prevent ember intrusion, the need to think about the vegetation pattern around your house, particularly close by, and with recent research, particularly within the first 5 feet around your house. So we can do a lot better there. The fact that many of these fires can move into areas like Santa Rosa show, though, that this is not simply an issue of we're living in areas we shouldn't be living in. There are some analogies to floodplain zoning that you could get into, in the sense that topography creates some wind-driven fires and will continue by the nature of the topography and the prevailing meteorological conditions, will create some corridors where you're going to get some risky situations. And I would say, though, dealing with that is a matter of making sure you have especially vigorous enforcement of building codes, retrofitting, and redesign of our transportation network. We've seen tragically that even good evacuation planning can be overwhelmed in the moment of evacuation. And most of the fatalities associated with wildfires are in the evacuation phase. So this is a transportation issue as much as it's a building issue.
Well, let me go to caller Renata in Berkeley. Hi, Renata.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to first express appreciation to all of the firefighters working on our behalf. And I wanted to share a comment from a firefighter friend when I asked him what we could do as citizens to help the crews that are working right now. And he said that the best thing that we can do is to be prepared to evacuate quickly if that should need to happen, and to sign up for the alert systems that are available in different counties. So Alameda County has AC alerts that you can sign up for online. To get the alert to the notification, you know, should you need to evacuate. And so I wanted to share that information. And then I also wanted to ask the panel if there was any other suggestions that they had of things that we could do, small or large, individual or as a community, to support the firefighters right now.
Renata, thanks. Keith Gillis?
Sorry. Yes, I have to say that stay attuned to what information is coming out. Make it easy for public safety officials to get information to you by signing up for opt-in communications. And as Chief McLean pointed out, if you just spend some time on the readyforwildfire.org website and look at what you can do in the moment, but even more importantly, what you should be doing before the moment, in terms of having an evacuation plan for your family, knowing where you're going to go and where you're going to reorganize if you're separated, and thinking about hardening your home so that your house stands a chance of surviving a fire. There are many homes within fire perimeters that do not ignite, and oftentimes it's the result of how those homes have been retrofitted, built, or maintained, and the way the vegetation's maintained. And so you don't want to be thinking about that in the moment. You want to have your vegetation correct. You want to really do as much to make your house resilient to the embers that are going to be landing on it, but also not a house which will present a danger to the firefighters or create additional workload. Let them move from, you know, dealing with the structure protection to just dealing with the fire. Same with evacuation. When you just listen to the evacuation warnings, comply with the mandatory evacuations, you're ending up freeing up tremendous amount of firefighting and public safety resources that doesn't have to deal in the initial stages of the fire simply with public safety. And they can get on with managing the fire much quicker.
Renata, thanks for that question. And Dan Brecke, there are also efforts on the forest management side of things, and even some progress if you count this signing of a major agreement with the federal government last week as one where it really talks about new ways to manage California's forests. Can you talk a little bit about what that is prescribing?
Yeah, so last week, while our fires really got going in the Bay Area, there was an agreement signed between the federal government and the state government to expand vegetation management programs in California forest lands. That sounds pretty wonky. It's not a new idea. I mean, people have had the idea of thinning forests for a long time. And in fact, the Forest Service used to pay individual landowners for thinning forests in among the national forest lands. But what's new is it's a greatly expanded program. The federal and state governments are the two largest landowners in the state, by the way, are adopting a program to try to treat 1 million acres a year of forest lands. And that means removing, thinning forests that have lots and lots of what they call, decadent growth, decades and decades, if not longer, of underbrush and dead wood that have just been left lying. And to gradually, over the next 15 to 20 years, move to a regime where fire could be used on a controlled scale to take over the sort of the human management that's necessary now. So, right now it will involve sending in crews with chainsaws and chippers and heavy equipment in some cases to manage these lands. And this has actually been happening on a much smaller scale. For instance, CAL FIRE announced a couple of years ago in the wake of the 2018 fires, a program for 35 different projects across the state, including one right here in the East Bay involving the Orinda Fire Department, to create what they call shaded fuel breaks. There's another one on Highway 17 in on the road between San Jose and Santa Cruz, and this is to again do the same thing of trying to manage what's on the ground, with the theory being that if you thin things out, then you minimize the chance that a real roaring fire will get started that becomes much hotter and much more damaging and much harder to stop.
And Keith Gillis, we're coming up on a break, but as we know, there's been this backlog on thinning out dead vegetation. Is this agreement going to really help jumpstart that?
I think it can. And the critical thing on this is think about two ways the California map looks when you're looking at an ownership map. One of the areas of the state where it's a checkerboard, a mixture of private and federal land. If you're trying to work at a landscape level, that checkerboard means you have to move beyond the ownership status. The other would be, think about the land ownership patterns along, say, Highway 70. You go up into a town like Quincy, you have private land and structures at risk in one area surrounded by a federal land matrix.
Well, Keith Gillis, we'll have more about this plan because I think it's really interesting, and also just generally about forest management after the break. We're talking about the latest news on California's wildfires with Keith Gillis, Professor and Dean Emeritus at the College of Natural Resources at UC Berkeley and Chair of the California Board of Forestry and Fire Protection. And of course, we're talking with Dan Brecke, editor and reporter for KQED News, who's been covering these fires. And we're talking with you, our listeners. Give us a call, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. More after the break. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with you, our listeners, about the California wildfires, especially those that are burning in the Bay Area, which have now, at least two of those, become the second and third largest in state history. To join the conversation, 866-733-6786 is the number to call. To join us online, you can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. We've got Keith Gillis with us and Dan Brecke. And Pam writes, I would like to hear more emphasis on water conservation and incentives to make it the new normal. Keith Gillis, connect that for us to this and the fires.
One simple linkage is that if you're managing the landscaping around your home to conserve your water use, you are simultaneously managing that vegetation to reduce your fire risk. The same plants, the same rules on spacing, and the same aesthetic principles would apply to the two. So water conservation is intimately linked to how we manage the vegetation around our homes and make them more fire resilient.
And Samuel writes, I'm tired of hearing about inmate firefighters simply as an additional resource. Can you please discuss what's actually going on, which is forced labor in life-threatening circumstances? I mean, Dan Brecky, Samuel has a point, right? I mean, you've got inmate firefighters working for almost nothing to fight these fires. And then when they leave, you know, very hard to hire.
Yeah, listen, that's an issue that's gotten a lot more attention recently. You know, we've taken this labor force for granted, and actually, I think it's easy to sort of take to assume the opinion that well, this is a good deal for the inmates because they're allowed a greater degree of trust and freedom, and they're actually learning a skill. That kind of attitude and or opinion. And the fact is that the two major things you've already pointed out, one is that they're paid next to nothing. And number two, there is, you know, they may be learning a skill, but then it's very, very difficult for them to get hired after they finish their debt to society and are released from prison. And, you know, the other thing here is, inmate firefighters get hurt or killed while training or on the line of duty, and they simply aren't afforded the same level of not protection. I mean, I think they're treated well by the system while they're working, but in terms of, you know, they don't have union representation or that kind of thing where their welfare is really being looked out for. So I think this is, you know, Samuel has actually touched on something that's very important, which is if we want to really maintain this force, changes have to be made. I think there's going to be more and more outcry for that as we go forward.
Keith writes, Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs could use more help preparing and sharing meals. We also anticipate another increase in people seeking food and clothing when the Red Cross evacuation shelters close down since the threat of fire has diminished. And so thanks for sharing that, Keith, as we had listeners earlier asking about ways to help. And let me go to caller Tyler in Alameda. Hi, Tyler. Join us.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great. What's on your mind?
Hey, so I was actually listening to you guys talking about this, and I feel like what's being talked about now is what was being talked about when President Trump visited Quint or Paradise with then-Governor Jerry Brown and Governor-elect Gavin Newsom saying, no, we need better forest management in California. President Trump was explaining that we needed better forest management in California and threatened withhold federal funding to California about better forest management. And when Donald Trump was saying this, I felt like it was completely ignored. But now that it's being said again, and the name Donald Trump's being removed, it's being revisited. Like, no, we should stay out of the forest a little bit. We should clear the brush, sweep the forest, is what he said then. But it's being talked about very seriously now. But when Donald Trump talked about it at the campfire in Paradise, it was ignored. And I wanted to get to why is it being revisited now as a serious option? But when Donald Trump said it, it wasn't.
Tyler, thanks. I mean, actually, my understanding, Keith Gillis, is that forest management was always on the minds. And one of the rejoinders to that complaint was, as you were hinting at earlier, the proportion of forest land that's actually federally owned. Can you address Tyler's comments?
Right. California forest management is complex. The board that I chair writes the forest practice rules and tries to manage, to some extent, incentivizing good forest management on private lands. We don't have any say over the public lands. And half of the forest land is federal here. And some of that federal land is managed very well. But since the 1980s, when the harvest level declined on the federal lands, there has been quite a buildup of fuel. You put that on top of decades of fire suppression, and you have, in some of the less intensively managed U.S. Forest Service lands, a much higher probability of a fire ignition. And with that much fuel loading, when you do get a fire, the consequences aren't so positive. The fire return interval might be less than 10 years historically in the Sierra Nevada, but you keep it out for 50, then you have a fire. It's not necessarily a good thing to reintroduce fire to the landscape that way. So we need to do more management on public lands. We need to do more management on some private lands, and we need to balance kind of the activities of harvesting and thinning, which are surrogates for fire, with where we can reintroduce fire safety. But the public health aspects mean that forestry is just one activity competing for the little band of air quality that we can utilize for a variety of different purposes, like agriculture and transportation in the state, wherever, you know, we make enough progress on air quality to allow us to consider doing something which will actually put some particulates or volatile organics or something in the air.
Well, Marjorie writes, I'm concerned that these fires eliminate nature's best carbon sink. What is the right balance between ensuring strong and healthy tree canopies and ecosystems and cutting trees and other vegetation for defensible space? I mean, this is definitely something that's been raised when thinning of forests has come up, Keith Gillis.
Yes, it's always a balance. We like to live in the wildlands or because of the aesthetics. We like to create artificial wildlands. The Berkeley Hills don't look like they would have historically. They don't even look like what was there as kind of a grassy oak woodland when the campus was founded. The truth is, though, you don't need to have paved over or gravel landscapes to dramatically improve your fire safety, especially if you do good transportation planning so that your roads are wide enough that public safety folks like fire trucks can go in at the same time evacuations are proceeding out, that you have your communities planned with multiple points of ingress and egress so that you don't result in a cutoff of, you know, sort of your one direction of flow. We can manage this situation. It's expensive. And in some cases you're undoing actions which in retrospect weren't such great ones, but we can live with fire in the same way that you live with natural hazards wherever you live on the planet. This is just our cross to bear, the same way hurricanes are down in the southeastern U.S. Earthquake hazards, I wish, you know, in the natural hazards literature, everyone that works in natural hazards reads the same literature because there's so many shared principles in terms of preparedness and management of incidents. It's great that we're paying some attention to fire right now, and I wish we had more sustained interest in how we could adapt ourselves here. But the literature on people's reaction to natural hazards shows again and again, people don't do well with low probability events. Their perception of risk is highly colored by their own personal experience or that of the experiences of those close to them. And the half-life of people's perception of what the risk is they're facing is very short. The difference that we have in California right now is that we have moved in fire to big fires essentially every year, not exactly every year, but close to every year. And we're really rethinking our relationship with fire now in a way that we should be with other natural hazards like earthquakes, but our experience with major earthquakes has such a wide spacing that it's hard to sustain the level of interest in how well adapted are we to our natural hazards with those. Whereas with fire, we're getting attention. It's appropriate attention. And I think the state, under both Governor Brown and Governor Newsom, is really leading the way and saying, this is not something that you deal with just running around and, you know, applauding heroes in the moment. It's something you have to go after on a sustained basis in your building codes, in your transportation planning, in your vegetation management. And, you know, we're trying to make the situation easier to deal with. The Board of Forestry certified under the California Environmental Quality Act recently a programmatic environmental impact report for vegetation management in the state. so that where you're dealing with a bog standard vegetation treatment around a community, and there's a lot of support for this, you don't have to do the same paperwork burden to simply proceed with something which doesn't have endangered species issues, which doesn't have too much fire on the landscape problems, which are present in some of the coastal communities where human fire starts means you're burning some communities too rapidly as opposed to the Sierra. So it's manageable, but it's tough.
Yes. Well, let me go to Shelley in San Francisco. Hi, Shelley.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment, which is that I'm really glad to hear that government forestry is turning a bit in terms of managing the forest and trying to get some of the fuel out so that when there is a fire, it's not so bad. And I also just wanted to say I grew up in Northern California and come from 5-6 generations of loggers. And I've lived in San Francisco for 30 years, and I've taken a lot of heat for coming from a logger family. There's a tremendous amount of judgment, particularly in the Bay Area, where people have a lot of wood furniture and wood floors and everything else about how bad loggers are. And I come from a group of people that really do care about the forest and really do believe in some selecting logging to take out some of that fuel that burns fires so hard. So I just wanted to put out there and say there's some small loggers out there. Give them a break.
Yeah. Well, Shelley, I really appreciate you sharing that perspective. And I mean, Dan Brecke, yes, this has definitely been an issue. Are environmental groups saying that they're generally supportive of thinning now as well?
They are. I mean, I think there's been a turn toward, I mean, looking at the results of, let's take a step back. I mean, I don't think major environmental groups like the Sierra Club, for instance, have been in favor of the 100% fire suppression model that's been in place. I mean, there's been criticism of that for decades, but I think there has been a turn toward realizing that, there's been a certain amount of neglect, and part of it is, maybe driven less by, cultural attitudes about logging than not prioritizing, how we address forest issues. And when I say, prioritizing, I mean, in terms of spending money on improving things or managing things. So, I take Shelley's point, and maybe the appropriate answer there is to, hate the logging and love the logger or something like that. But I think that, there has been a sort of a public attitude shift about this.
Well, let me go to Brian in San Francisco. Hi, Brian.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I definitely believe climate change is real and that the fires are worse because of climate change. But I also think we haven't been tending the land as it was intended for at least decades or centuries because indigenous Native Americans haven't been able to tend it as they have. Can we talk about the contributions of indigenous culture in cultivating this land and how we're moving forward to incorporate that into land management?
Brian,
I could take the answer off the line.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate that. I mean, has there been some engagement with indigenous people, Keith Gillis, in terms of land stewardship?
Not enough. There is increasing engagement because, as the caller points out, fire was a very important part of the Native American toolkit for managing their relationship with the environment. And the landscape that we think of as natural, the landscape that was reported in the early, European journals about California, was in fact an intensively and well-managed landscape reflecting Native American cultural practices. And so there are some members of the Native American community in California that are speaking quite eloquently about this, that are being brought into policy discussions. In the last term I served on the federal Forestry Research Advisory Council to the USDA. They had even recognized this at that level and were starting to bring Native American voices onto that research advisory committee. It's something where we need to mainstream the relationships, and that we have something to learn that goes well beyond the boundaries of the land, which are directly under Native American management.
Well, this listener tweets, I'm lucky to not live close enough to be evacuated, but smoke has closed our three-year-old's nursery, which was outside due to COVID concerns. This means we're back to not having childcare and needing one parent to step in. Cabin fever is definitely setting in. Again, a ripple effect of these fires. This listener tweets, I'm honestly really struggling. Fire is crawling towards my house. I feel like these two comments really encapsulate what so many of us are feeling right now with this, with these wildfires, on top of what we've been going through related to the pandemic, the economic issues, and so on. And I guess I just have to ask you, Keith Gillis, in the last minute that we have, I mean, we're talking about the state having this new commitment towards vegetation management and maybe some resources through the federal government to help do that more. Do you think we can sustain this given everything that's going on right now?
Over the longer time period, yes. In the short time timeline, the state's going to have to do a lot of delicate balancing here. That someone who's trained in forestry and economics and did a lot of work in rural development, the fact is the pandemic has wiped out a tremendous number of households. Entire wealth accumulation. And so the number of households that are on the edge, not just emotionally, but financially, says that whatever our priorities were, not just for forestry, but for all public expenditures before the pandemic, will need to be reevaluated in light of what American families are going through right now.
And Dan Brecke, last word to you in terms of what we should be watching for today.
Well, you know, the weather, the heat wave inland has not stopped. There are very tough conditions for firefighters, but the number of firefighters on the line has about doubled from last Thursday. And as Scott McLean said earlier in the hour, there is progress being made. These fires are going to burn for weeks. We're going to see signs of smoke and other effects for some time to come.
Take steps now. Dan Brecke with KQED News, Keith Gillis with the Natural Resource, with College of Natural Resources at UC Berkeley and the California Board of Forestry and Fire Protection. Ariana Prail and Dan Zoll produced today's segment. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks for listening. Stay safe.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.
This is Barbara Leslie, president of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way, from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.